or one-sided than you come to expect. Even from NPR, it was terrible, and I went into detail. A few things have come out since then. I don't know how many people listened or watch RT, which is Russia Today. It's a television show which is on the internet, and it's paid for, as our media never tire of telling us, is paid for by the Kremlin. Yep. And but their production values are really pretty good, and they've hired a pretty good stable of reporters, including I think they even got Larry King working for them. But anyway, one of their stars is a woman named Abby Martin, and I've seen some of her shows. She interviews people, and she is really good. She's very sharp. Anyway, on her regular show, which I think called Smashing the Set, she said at the end of her show, she said that Russia was wrong to go into Crimea. And, you know, she said she knows that Russia is her employer, but she said that they are wrong. She could not be silent about this. Well, our media, of course, made a huge thing out of it, which, well, it was quite a story, you know, that here this person was... kind of ding your own employer and speaking out when she saw something wrong. Well, so what they didn't say was what she said about the U.S. media. And I heard her as a program on an NPR show called On the Media, which is on Saturdays at 6. And the last show, she was interviewed by one of their hosts, Bob Garfield. And she told her story about why she thought Russia was really wrong to go into Crimea. And he tried to, you know, he's talking about how, you know, the RT is sponsored or paid for by Russia and everything. He's sort of implying that you can't trust anything they say. And she came right back and said, well, who is the U.S. media funded by? You know, and she really, she wanted quite a little bit of a rant about the U.S. media and how bad it's been covering this whole thing. I think she kind of surprised Bob Garfield. You know, he kind of seemed to try to want to steer the conversation away. So she sort of came down blasting away at both sides in this. And then she was also on CNN and did the same thing. So I thought this is very interesting. And Abby Martin is still employed by RT. She still does her show. And so this says something right there that RT is willing to have a show where the person doing the show has come out against their own policies. In fact, Abby Martin brought up, you know, what about the U.S. media? And she brought up kind of old stuff where during the Iraq War, some of the U.S. Reporters were actually fired by their television sponsors. So anyway, that's an interesting sidelight on the media. We are taking, this is a call-in show. The number is 503-231-8187. Oh, we got Joanne on the line. Morning, Joanne.
Yes. Hello. I have an awful lot of questions, but I got a lot of neck pain.
Okay.
So I have to ask one.
Sure.
About Russia.
Uh-huh.
You know, about the Olympic Games, I was wondering, I don't really pay that much attention, but lately I have a little bit. So, have the Olympic Games ended? And it blows my mind, which is already blown away already with a lot of things, about all the money that goes into the Olympics. And I wonder about after the Olympics ends, what happens to all that land and property? But I realize you want to talk about Ukraine and that, but I'll get off the phone. Bye.
Well, that's a good question. Apparently, what I heard was that Russia spent $51 billion on the Sochi Olympics, which is sort of the record. I think the previous record was $41 billion. a lot of times what happens is, you know, when a city has a host the Olympics, they build stadiums and all kinds of venues and things. And after the Olympics are over, they're really they're not used for anything at all. It's kind of like, I think this happened in Montreal way back when. Brazil is gearing up for some, they're building football stadiums down there that are collapsing on them. I don't know about the Russian, supposedly, the last I heard was that the what they did in Sochi, which is on the Black Sea, it's kind of a strange place to have a Winter Olympics because it's pretty tropical weather there, although there are mountains nearby. But they apparently they did a fairly smart job of putting up buildings that can be used in the future. Some people say that you know, the Olympics in Sochi were sort of Putin's way of showing the world that Russia's a dynamic, progressive country and all that, you know, and that the U.S. and NATO had sort of timed the uprising in Ukraine to come during the Olympics for two reasons. One would be that it would kind of take a little shine off of Putin's show in Sochi, and it would also make it harder for him to clamp down on the protesters. Of course, that assumes scenario assumes that the U.S. and the West had much to do with the timing of the protests, which is possible. But anyway, that now the Olympics are over. I think what's happening now is they have the Paralympics, and this is a kind of fairly recent thing in sports where you have the athletes are all kind of disabled in one way or another, and they have these interesting sports, like they have something called, boy, it's kind of like an ice hockey where the athletes sit on these kind of sleds and propel themselves around the ice with their hands. I'm not sure exactly how it's done, but apparently they really speed around the ice and they really go at it. But so that, as far as I know, I think the Paralympics are still going on because of the uprising in Ukraine. Some countries have not taken part in this, although I think the U.S. athletes on their own have gone to it. But that's my best answer to Joanne's question. Well, let's talk a little bit about the oligarchs. We hear a lot about the oligarchs, and who were they? We'd have to go back to, 1990 or whatever, whenever the Soviet Union collapsed. And what happened was that in all the turmoil and chaos, it was a very nonviolent collapse, but there's a lot of chaos and uncertainty going on. And in that period, a lot of sort of wheeler dealers had a chance to take control of state property. By state property, we mean, you know, factories and all kinds of things that actually, you know, supposedly belonged to the people of the Soviet Union, the people of Russia. And these guys, as far as I know, just about every one of them is a guy, they took control of these enterprises, state property, and they bled them. They used them for their own sources. They made a lot of money. They made billions, and they bought state property cheap, and they sold it off to foreign investors. And there's quite a lot of these oligarchs. As far as I can tell, from the Boris Yeltsin era, he was the one who really enabled all this stuff. And in the Yeltsin era, there were at least seven oligarchs. Then later on, he was succeeded by Vladimir Putin, and then there were nine more oligarchs. And then in the Ukraine, there are, as far as I can tell, about 13 oligarchs. And they are taken different sides. According to journalist Robert Parry, there are 10 oligarchs actually run the Ukraine. And we will get into that later if people want. And right now, we'll take our next phone caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was watching things unfold for, the year before the Olympics actually occurred. And there was some pretty interesting developments in U.S.-Russian relations. And by U.S., I include the EU, too.
Sure.
And Canada, of course. And what I had noticed was that, first of all, Obama never had to get defensive about the fact that Putin was actually instituting a economic stimulus program that the United States was ideologically opposed to by both Democrats and Republicans.
How do you mean?
Well, in the elections, anytime any back then, Obama's first election, anytime anybody raised the issue of we need to put people to work, I mean, this was Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman's continuing theme in his column in the New York Times, we've got to put people to work. Obama never backed down from the Republican and Tea Party assertion that ahistorically cuts out how we got out of the first depression, but they just kept agreeing with the Tea Party and Republicans, saying it isn't government's job to create jobs, it's the private sector's create jobs. And here was Putin basically investing in the Russian people, because who built Sochi but Russians? They didn't bring in a whole lot of foreign labor. And this should have been a major embarrassment to the Obama administration if there was anybody in accredited American journalism to actually ask about that.
Well, it's interesting that Robert Parry, who he's a longtime journalist. Back in the 80s, he exposed a lot of undercover murders in El Salvador. I think he was fired by his TV company or whatever.
AP. He was with AP.
Oh, okay. And he's been writing a lot of stuff in Consortium News. And one of the things he says, I don't know if I quite believe it or not, but he says there's a kind of informal kind of alliance between Obama and Putin, where Obama is very reluctant to get into wars. He's being pushed and prodded by the military and the neocons. And in some ways, Putin has sort of saved his skin. Like Putin was the one who sort of worked it out so that Bashar Assad in Syria would give up his chemical weapons. And
well, that was Kerry's flub, and Kerry was the one who personally got saved, because apparently Obama was denying there was any consultation between Kerry and Obama, and that Kerry basically threw that out as an aside.
And then Putin kind of jumped in and turned it around. So, this is Robert Parry's theory. I don't know. It may be true. It reminds me of President John F. Kennedy, his problems with the military people then, you know, that, you know, we think of Kennedy as sort of an imperialist. He was. But he certainly did a lot to anger the military, and you see what happened to him.
Well, that's going in yet another direction that I think we need to go into. And if we had journalists like Parry who were accredited and not afraid of losing their jobs, and I'm very glad you mentioned this Abby Martin case with RT and her coming on to Bob Garfield's show, because a few years ago I engaged in an email exchange with Mr. Garfield.
Oh, really? Okay.
I happened to have seen that he was named the Public Relations Industry's Man of the Year and had received an award for that. And I had written him an email a few years before he received that award, which was unresponded to, in which I proposed that one of the shows be looking at those publicity PR firms like Hill and Knowlton that would take on clients whose clients were basically dictators.
Right.
You had the Duvalier family being represented by an American public relations firm. And this was all during the Cold War years, where, you know, we had no end of publicity against people who chose different economic paths. And And I don't mean to confuse those who chose different economic paths like Allende and Chile with dictators. I was merely asking why it is that only off-the-reservation journalists like Alex Coburn could do any writing about America's PR industry and the shaping of our policies.
Did you ever get an answer from...
Well, after... A couple of years after he won the PR Industry Man of the Year, I started writing to him again, and OPB was actually carrying his program at that point. And he did write back, not addressing the fact that he was the PR Industry's Man of the Year, but noting that that was a good subject and they would look into it. And I thought that was, you know, because I was still pressing him on that very issue, because there was nothing he could point to in corporate journalism that ever looked at those PR firms. And then what happened in the year leading up to Sochi was that Putin used Ketchum Communications, one of the largest PR firms in America, to place op-ed pieces in American newspapers of record like the New York Times.
There was Hill and Knowlton. Were they the ones behind the big incubator baby thing? During the Iraq War?
And the Northern California representative, Tom Lantosh. Yeah, it was Hill. I'm pretty sure that was Hill and Knowlton. But the point is that here was Putin feeling that he needed Ketchum Communications to help him get his view as to what he was doing with the Olympics and what he was doing economically in these hard times, and trying to bridge the gap and meet the EU. Because actually, Putin was afraid of Ukleptokraine becoming an economic burden on Russia. And what we're finding now is that the EU wanted to slip back into this Cold War industrial mindset so quickly, because they don't have any answers for putting their people back to work either, that what they were doing was assuming that it would be Western money, as strained as we are in the West, it would be Western money that would bail out the kleptocrats of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I thought Putin was smart enough to sort of not go into, well, he's already in Crimea, and the fact that he invaded is a bit of a rhetorical conflation of what they did. They simply assigned more troops to their already existing bases in Crimea.
Right. Uh-huh.
But the point is that I thought Putin would have been happy to let the West bail out these kleptocrats, because where did Yanukovych's money go anyway? It didn't go into Russian banks. His money, he wouldn't trust Russian banks for the same reason that all the Russians were banking in Cyprus when the Cyprus banking system blew up. They put their money where they can trust it'll be there. That's Switzerland, that's Luxembourg, that's the U.S. banks, usually Wachovia on the East Coast.
Wow, you know, boy, you're raising all kinds of interesting stuff, and I think we got some other callers on the line, but those are really good questions.
But please have your listeners look at Putin using Ketchum Communications, and the next time their leaders slip in a Cold War rhetoric, ask them about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to our next caller, let me tell you what's coming up on KBOO. Actually, Robert Perry will be on later on this morning. At 9 o'clock, we hear Economic Update with host Richard Wolff. And he will talk about Ben Bernanke's speech on the Fed's bailout of the biggest financial corporations and new IMF research showing that redistribution to reduce inequality does not hurt growth. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentaries. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a report from Fukushima 3 years after the meltdown and tsunami. We'll hear about a new report suggesting that people living around a nuclear reactor in California are suffering negative health impacts. And journalist Robert Perry talks about the real politics driving the Ukraine and the U.S. involvement in what many have called a soft coup. So that is really something to stay tuned for. And then at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen speaks with gardening book author Maggie Stuckey about growing vegetables in containers. So thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Never too late. If you would like to become a member, please go to KBOO FM, KBOO.FM, and click on Donate Today. So now let's go to our next caller. Dan is on the air.
Pear, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. Got a cold, but I'm feeling okay.
Good job overall, but I have one very significant nit to pick.
Okay. And, pick away.
You gave a good summary of what's happening in Ukraine, but boy, did you overstep when you said that the protesters hired the snipers. What the Estonian foreign minister actually said was that the signatures of the bullets that ended up both in the police there and in the protesters was the same, indicating
right,
a single
yes,
source for
that's
them.
Right,
but
yeah.
It has never come out in any kind of proof. The implication
I don't
is
think I that, said it's been proven. I just said this is a story going around. There's one.
No, you said the snipers. You said the protesters hired the snipers.
Well,
and
I was saying
no apologist for you, the president there or the Russians or anything, but
well, some people said that the protesters hired the snipers. I am not saying that, but there's some people are saying that. Maybe not the Estonian foreign minister, but some people are alleging that the protesters are the ones who hired the snipers.
Well, but, I'm afraid the nuance was not present in your initial
Okay, well, let me clear that up.
Presentation. But otherwise, many kudos from here, and I'll let you carry on.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
I just do think that this is something that needs to be investigated. We've been assuming all along that the snipers were hired by the Ukrainian government, and that is seriously being questioned. So, but we apparently, and this is attested to by a woman doctor, Olga Bologomets, who said that the snipers she's been experienced in dealing with these kind of wounds said that they the source was the same. In other words, that the police who were shot and the protesters who were shot by the same group of snipers. So, without saying whose side they were on. So this is certainly worth investigating, and it's certainly, we should not jump to the conclusion that it was a government doing this. Maybe not. But anyway, let's go on to our next caller. Steve is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to clarify 2 points here. First, to pick up on this thing about the snipers.
Uh-huh.
What happened is that this Dr. Olga Bohomoyets, she was with the protesters and had been kind of a Florence Nightingale figure taking care of wounded protesters.
Right.
Now, she, in a brief conversation with the Estonian foreign minister, talked about the same signature or handwriting with the police who had been shot. However, she later clarified this in the Telegraph to the British newspaper that she had not actually examined the bodies of the police, only those of the protesters, because that was the side of the line that she was on. So she was getting her information from photographs and that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
Now, RT on the 20th of February, you can go back and Google that and check me out, ran a story talking about two groups of snipers, one the government snipers and two snipers in a hotel and perhaps in one or two other locations behind the protesters, and that they were firing. Actually, they were in kind of a battle with one another. The two groups of snipers were shooting at one another, and as well as at people down on the ground below.
Okay.
There have been some videos that have come out that allege to prove that the protesters were shot by the snipers from the rear. And I don't see how they prove that. I see a red line that's supposed to show the bullet's path, but I cannot see the bullets going. You can take a picture of a bullet in flight photographically, but not with the kind of cameras that are used to show news stories. So I don't know, there are 2 points that I think need to be made. There should be an investigation, and then look for two things. First, apparently it should be possible to get the bullets that killed the protesters and the bullets that killed the police. Ballistic science can tell if they came from the same barrels. And secondly, were the protesters shot in the back? Now, of course, not 100%. There could be hundreds of reasons why someone could have turned around. But if a substantial number of protesters were shot from the back, and this can be easily determined by forensic medicine, then you can argue that these snipers were not hired by the government, but by somebody on the other side. I wouldn't put it past some of these far-right groups to do this sort of thing, but we're very far from having any evidence that this is the case. RT did allow that there were government sharpshooters in the action on the 20th of February. Now, the second point is that this deal that was made briefly by three people representing, it's really almost hard to call them leaders, but they were people who had a prominent role, and they negotiated a deal.
And one of them is now the president of Ukraine, too.
They negotiated a deal with Yanukovych. The deal did not mean that, you know, he did not say that he was going to resign. What he did was that he himself had put in a new constitution that gave much greater power to the presidency, and he agreed to go back to the old constitution where the power is more equally distributed between the presidency and the legislature. And the second thing is, no, he did not say that there would be elections in May. The elections were scheduled for 2015, and he allowed that there would be elections no later than December of this year, but certainly not as early as May.
Well, I think, I don't know, my information was that they did move it up to May. But anyway, there was this deal between these sort of the political leaders, the guy who's president now, also with Klitschko, who was mentioned by Victoria Nuland in her leaked phone call. So there had been this deal arranged, but that was not good enough for the people in the street.
Well, the reason it wasn't good enough was because that was just in the aftermath of the scores of protesters being shot by snipers. Now, whoever shot them, and that still is up in the air, the view of the protesters, of course, is that it was the government people who had shot them. If that deal had been made a couple of days earlier, I think it would have stood. But now the protesters regarded Yanukovych as a shameless murderer, and by that time they were in no mood to accept him in power at all and demanded that he resign. He didn't offer to resign. In the end, he bugged out to eastern Ukraine, and then at one time said he was going to resign and then took it back.
Well, he claims that he fled for his life, but anyway.
Well, yeah, he claims, and of course that's something else that historians have to examine. But in the meantime, even while this deal was still thought of as a possibility, many of the deputies of his party to the legislature resigned.
And yeah, I understand that they resigned because you had these characters from the right sector sort of standing in the parliament kind of in a very threatening way. But anyway, go on from that.
Whatever his reasons for going, and I imagine that he was getting pretty frightened, he was gone. And at this point, we have a kind of a messy situation, but the remaining parliament declared that he would be regarded as having resigned his office.
Okay.
So that's what happened. Now, by the way, the deal, the initial deal that fell through, also Putin did not endorse it. He refused to sign off on it. So it wasn't just the protesters.
Okay. Well, this is something to check out some more. I do have an article by regarding the snipers by a man named F. William Engdahl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been reading a lot of his stuff over the years. He's actually born in the U.S., but he's lived in Germany for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's writing in the Global Research.
I'm aware of Global Research.
Right.
They're closely aligned with RT.
Well, yeah, okay. I think a lot of times you read stories by articles by Michelle Chosadowski, and they come out of Global Research. And Engdahl is saying, if I can find it here, is that in this article, let me give it the date on it if you want to look it up. It's, let's see, where's the date? Oh, March 3rd. He is saying that the snipers... I guess they belong to some group called UNA-UNSO, and that is the Ukrainian National Assembly-Ukrainian People Self-Defense. And that he's they are some kind of, according to Engdahl, they are some kind of neo-Nazi militia or something. And he goes on about the leader of this group is a fellow named Andrei Shkiel, who 10 years ago was an advisor to Yulia Tymoshenko during the Orange Revolution. And he quotes a few unsavory things about Shkiel. And he also ties this to a NATO, a secret NATO organization called Operation Gladio, which goes back to the end of World War II. And Gladio... At that time, you know, our military planners, NATO, has sort of supposedly feared that the Russians would overrun Europe, which apparently they had never had any intention to do. But anyway, that was the story. And that if they did overrun Europe, you would need to leave, besides fighting them and maybe retreating, you would need to leave resistance organizations behind to operate within the Soviet-conquered Europe. And that's where they set up this Gladio organization, which kind of evolved into a bunch of, secret operations, and they were tied to all sorts of supposed terrorist activities later on. But that is what William Engdahl says, so that is something to check out.
Well, I have a look at it. I would regard anything from Global Research as being essentially coming from RT.
Okay.
And
well,
so you've got to be a little cautious about bias there.
Well, but I'm cautious about our media too, with good reason.
Within a very short time of that phone call from Dr. Bohomolyets to the Estonian foreign minister being published, there were people coming out and saying that, well, the snipers were hired by the government and they were trained by NATO in the Baltic states. NATO, the Baltic states, are all regular targets of Russian propaganda. The Baltic states refused to join the Commonwealth of Independent States. They are aware, as almost no one in this country seems to be, of the Karaganov Doctrine of 1992. You never hear anybody talking about that at all.
Which is what?
Karaganov is the top political scientist in Russia now. And the 1992 article was talking about the breakup of the Soviet Union and said now we have Russia surrounded by these former Soviet republics. And how are we going to react to it? He said, well, on the one hand, we could just let them go their own way. But that doesn't work because they're too politically unstable. And then the opposite thing would be what he called normal imperialism, just conquer them militarily, which is, of course, what they had done historically before. And he said, well, we can't do that because we're not strong enough and the world situation is different and everybody would be against us. And the third thing, what his recommendation was to use the Russian populations in almost all of these former Soviet republics, quote unquote, as the point of leverage, whereby claiming to be to defend the interests of these Russians, the Russian state could come to control political processes in the former Soviet Union. And I think this has actually been there, at least in the background, and I think nowadays rather in the foreground of what they are doing.
Well, in the Crimea, there's a real self-determination issue. You have an area that was really never part of Ukraine. In fact, well, actually, the whole concept of the Ukrainian nation is very recent. And so there's a real issue here. Why should people in Crimea, who are mainly Russian-speaking, they want to have a relations with Russia, why should they be ruled by Kiev? I mean, it makes no sense.
Well, okay, now then...
And the Russians, their reason for going into Crimea was they were allowed to have troops there anyway under some agreement, and also the new government in Kiev had apparently had taken measures against, they took away the Russian language is a legal second language, and they had banned the Communist Party, and they did this and did that.
Well, they did abolish a law which had officially given Russian government status. This was a very stupid move, but it didn't really have very much effect because all the people that speak Russian were going to go on speaking it. The pretext for going in there was sufficient. It was supposedly to defend the interests of the Russians, and the Russians were never under any threat whatsoever in Crimea. In other words, this was simply a phony excuse for sending in more troops and then denying that they had been sent in. Putin continues to deny that he did it, and it's obviously false.
Well, the people in Crimea welcomed them, and they're going to have a referendum.
Now, would you agree to having a referendum that party in Alaska that wants to withdraw from the United States? But in the Crimea, would you agree to having a referendum that the Crimean Tatars can secede from Crimea if it goes with Russia and rejoin Ukraine? Because
that's a good question.
They would certainly vote for it.
Well, there is a precedent for that. You know, I mean, the U.S. right now, Nate, the West is saying that this referendum is illegal. There's no reason for it. They're also talking about international boundaries and whatever. Mm-hmm. This is very similar to when Yugoslavia broke up. The U.S. had no problem with breaking up Yugoslavia, and then if it was okay for Bosnia to secede from Yugoslavia, then the question arose, or was never answered, why couldn't Serbs within Bosnia secede from that? So, I mean, this has happened before.
Oh, it's happened before, but I don't think you can really say that the West was responsible for Yugoslavia breaking up.
Well, I think we could, but that's a whole new story. I mean, once it did break up, the West did a whole lot of stuff to keep it broken up and took advantage of it.
They did a whole lot of very ill-advised things. I have no quarrel with you on that at all. The West did a great deal of harm.
But the main point now is that the issue of sovereignty and self-determination and how far down the line does self-determination go?
Yeah.
This is an issue that has been raised before, and it's something we need to discuss. And I would say, as far as Crimea goes, that they let them have their election and see how it goes. You can tell whether it's been a fair election or whether there's been coercion or whatever.
Well,
but the U.S. is just saying that it's sort of illegal right from the start, and I would dispute that.
Well, it probably is illegal according to international law, because international law is designed largely to protect existing boundaries.
Yes. Well, okay.
And a plebiscite like that is supposedly should be agreed on by the government. This is a very thorny issue, and it's one that's really insoluble, I think, within our present framework to begin with.
Well,
we've had plenty, Bangladesh seceded from Pakistan, and...
of course, Pakistan split off from India.
Pakistan seceded from India.
And then there's Kashmir, which was promised an election. They never got it, they've been conquered ever since, and the source of a lot of terrorism. So, I mean, this is an issue that the great powers really don't want to discuss in any rational way. They take advantage of it for their own, their own purposes. So,
well, I agree with that. And, of course, China is worried about this because... why not run an election, a plebiscite like that in Tibet and Xinjiang?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, my feeling is I would like to see plebiscites all over the world. Maybe we need about 1,000 different nations. You know, who sets these borders up? If you look at the history of almost any nation, their borders were created by violence and war and, you know, riding roughshod over the wishes of the people who live there. So I'm sort of, I would favor having these kind of plebiscites everywhere. The only problem is that the big powers, they're not satisfied with that. They want to kind of get in there and monkey around and try and push things their way. So, you know, they muddy the waters. But I really believe in the right of self-determination everywhere. Yeah, unless there's a real good reason not to.
You do have to face the problem of how far down the line it goes.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And so on and so on, because there's always somebody around who says, I don't want to live under the government I'm under now.
That's true, yeah. Well, I don't know.
My
neighborhood wants to secede from Portland. That'd be kind of crazy. But, you know, I mean, how far up the big government line do you want to go? I mean, you could say we have a global government. Well, that sounds very nice. You're going to go to the world government to have your streets repaired here in Portland or what? I mean, there's a question of jurisdiction, you know.
Yeah, and,
who's
and
responsible for what?
If you have a world government that goes really bad, where can you flee to?
That's a very good question. Well, thank you for your questions, and I think you've given our listeners a lot of things to check out and check out William Engdahl and see what he has to say about the snipers. This is a continuing story, which is why we are doing this program now, even though it's several weeks after this whole thing erupted. So,
Oh, well, you know, it's still a live issue because now it's going on in Crimea.
Right.
We'll see if that spreads to the eastern part of Ukraine.
Well, we will see. I was going to get into sort of what we might expect in the future, but do we have any more calls on the line?
Okay.
Let's go to our other callers. Who's next on next in line? Sherelle, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. Well, number one, I'd like to know more about the party that's come into primary power in the Ukraine, because you say they're ultra-right wing. Additionally, since it sounds like through your appraisal of the situation and the appraisal of many others that we helped institute ultra-right wing neo-Nazis, aren't we kind of splitting hairs, because we know the Russians ran into the Nazis before, and also the Crimea, isn't it near the Russian nuclear sub-fleet? So what was our government doing enabling such a purposefully destabilizing situation? And isn't this perhaps just as serious as the missile crises in Cuba? Then the last thing I'd like to say is we have our own homegrown neo-Nazi movement, and a lot of them are Aleister Crowley followers, whom Adolf Hitler admired Aleister Crowley. And we have many of these people in our own region, and they're oftentimes hippie liberal types who truly secretly... Now, wait, let me finish.
All right.
They despise the disabled. They are racist. They are super followers of Aleister Crowley. They're called Crobots. And as a survivor of genocide and a person who was previously disabled, who's recovered my health, I am sounding out the threat about these people, because I've had to deal with them personally.
Okay.
And there are increasing numbers of them. There are quite a number of them that work at KABU. And there are a lot of other people that have come across these
people.
Let me finish. So let's really talk about the Nazi threat in the Ukraine, because that's no laughing matter. If they're there, if that's what they are, or if that's what that party is doing or is associated with, that's probably a big part of the problem, and that's what's got a lot of Americans upset and the Russians upset. And of course the Russians are going to be very touchy about their nuclear subfleet.
Okay, now it's time for me to answer your question, if I can. For one thing,
thank you.
The party that's in power now is I am not calling them a neo-Nazi party. They are not. They are the head of the
You said they were ultra right, though. What are they?
The government. The government in charge now is ruled by one of the three political opponents of Yanukovych, and he is regarded as a technocrat, very closely allied to the IMF and the European Union. I would consider them kind of moderate, right wing. I mean, they have been pushing austerity in Europe, and they'll be pushing austerity on Ukraine. As far as
I'm still answering
your question. The right wingers are these people from the streets who are not. Some of them are in the government, as a matter of fact, not in the most crucial positions. But some of these people are in the government. As far as Aleister Crowley goes, now he was a son of American or British Satanist back in about 100 years ago, and I'm not going to go into that right now. But you can lots of weird people around the world, and I don't know if it's possible to link them all together. But anyway,
I'm not trying to link them. I'm saying that we have a problem in America with increasing numbers of those people.
Well, we have all kinds of neo-Nazis. We have all kinds of far-right people. Anyway,
this is true.
Okay, let me go on my next caller.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, you're on the air. We have another caller?
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad the first thing you brought up was how our media reacted to this.
Oh,
a lot of people caught on.
Been bugging me for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, the first thing that the media would first say was, in their reports, was Ukraine is trying to get closer to the West. They gave their conclusion and their political, what the government wants, first. Then they told you the report. And a lot of people saw that right off, and it says, what's going on here? The last caller, he didn't like RT, but we have to get other news sources that are not controlled by our government.
Right.
Our media is controlled by the Patriot Act, so the government can do or say anything. That's why they all say the same thing at the same time.
Well, I've noticed the thing about our coverage is that, you know, on NPR, you know, they have the same officials, same former officials, same think tank people. You know, they keep coming and saying the same old stuff. And especially now, you know, that OPB here has changed its format a lot. So, you know, you have the morning edition, then you have the John Hockenberry show, and then you have the show from Boston, and then you have the local show, and then you have the BBC, and then you get back into... there's a Canadian program, and then there's the All Things Considered. So you have sort of nonstop news, but the same people keep appearing, you know. And
what's that called? Propaganda.
I would call saturation, but yeah, propaganda. Yeah, it's and they keep saying the same stuff. You keep the same guests will appear and on each of these shows. And it's just too much. It's like even the interviews of people in the streets, or you know, it's like it's so heavily one-sided.
Yeah, and it's our media is controlled by the Patriot Act and let alone the government. But the only way to get RT is not controlled by our government.
Well, it's controlled by their government.
But you know why? Because there's no U.S. troops there.
Well,
the French. There was no U.S. troops in France, so try to get any French news media. It's very hard to. In England, of course, we have troops in England. We control the BBC. So,
well, the British do a good job. BBC is kind of a weird thing. I listen to BBC. I even listen to it at night sometimes. I have it on the, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and I hear BBC and. Some of their news people seem pretty good, and others seem pretty dreadful. It seems like a real mix.
Who owns BBC?
Well, so I guess it's owned by the British government.
No, it's not. The British government sold it. It's run by the same guy who owns the Wall Street Journal. What's his name?
Murdoch?
Yeah, Murdoch owns it.
Are you sure about that?
Yep.
Well,
he owns the Fox, too. So so I can tell.
Well, I know Murdoch. Yeah, well, he owns the New York Post, I guess.
Yeah.
I did not know that Murdoch owned BBC. That's something we should check up on. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not.
Well, another thing I've noticed was about the Ukraine is Obama seems to hate Putin. He refused to go to the Winter Olympics. He said he wasn't going to go.
Well, this is interesting. I mentioned before in this show that Robert Perry is sort of floating this idea that actually Obama is being hemmed in by his own neocons, which he foolishly allowed into his own government, and that he sort of has a kind of a behind-the-scenes unofficial alliance with Putin, and that Obama is trying to avoid going into war, but he's being sabotaged by some of the people in his own government who are neocons, been sort of planning this kind of thing for years. Now that's
Maybe that might be a good excuse for him, but you also have to remember when Dennis Rodman went to North Korea, the president of North Korea gave a letter to Dennis Rodman to give to Obama. Obama said, "I'm not accepting the letter." So you have to remember sometimes you have to leave it right where it is, Obama.
Well, speaking of Rodman, didn't he? I heard something about he made a tearful confession just the other day that he really felt manipulated. I don't know that he really sort of retracted all the nice things he said about North Korea, but I didn't really read that story. I just saw the headline.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea that he wouldn't accept that letter, and we gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. I think we need to take away from him.
Some part of me wondered whether Dennis Rodman wasn't some kind of sort of undercover, sort of emissary from the government, you know. Who knows?
He gave a lot of, you got to remember, the government put a lot of pressure on him, again, the Patriot Act, and that's why he was probably forced to do that, because what did the media first do? The first thing they did was they threw out someone here in Oregon's relative got jailed in North Korea.
Right.
Okay. And, of course, that's the first thing they bring up. What about this? What about this? Well, he's trying to bridge a gap of peace. In fact, Dennis Rodman should be given the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, I don't know. He deserves a prize for something anyway. He's kind of an odd duck, but anyway.
Yeah. But before I go, the last thing I'll say is remember the Ukraine has an elected president, and he can... If he wants to, he can actually go in Kiev and clear it out and be legally to do that. But he doesn't.
That's a thing to remember, that
an elected
president was overthrown, and so...
He hasn't been overthrown. He just left.
Well, he's been forced to flee.
So it's going to be a civil war.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I'm going to wrap it up now, and thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Do we have time for one last call, if there are any? Okay, one last caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Gil Carrasco. I'm a professor at Willamette Law School.
Uh-huh.
And I'm married to a Ukrainian law professor at the National University. And we've been following this series of events very closely by stream from Ukraine and from Maidan directly.
Uh-huh.
And I've been very disturbed by what I've been hearing from the left. And I'm a very progressive civil rights lawyer myself. And the origin of Maidan resulted from the decision of Yanukovych to snub the European Union and turn to the east, toward
Russia. Wasn't that his prerogative? I mean, he was a president, elected president.
Okay, let's say that it's his prerogative as president.
Uh-huh.
But the people are more important than the president. And the people rose up against this. And the main protest originally in Maidan was that of students, the young generation, who look to the West for hope, for democracy, for a possibility of freedom. There's great oppression in Russia, and you know the right of freedom of speech is very limited. In the West, they view United States and the European Union as protecting the right to protest and protecting the freedoms that we all desire and revere.
Well, I hear my music is playing. I wish I'd been able to talk to you sooner. We could go into this some more. But
I wish so, too.
I would kind of dispute some of the things you're saying, or else put a different take on it. Because
I would dispute a lot of what's been said today on the radio.
Okay, well, maybe we'll do this again. Thank you for calling, and the show is over. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
KABU is a proud media co-sponsor of March Music Modern 4 for 2014. Listening to the Here of the Now. Beginning Friday, March 3rd, and running through Sunday, March 16th, 32 events, 20th and 21st century music, concerts, movies, and more. Music by composers from near and far, performed by both local and internationally acclaimed musicians at a variety of venues throughout Portland. Many of these events are free. That's March Music Modern. More information at the KABU homepage under Community Events or at marchmusicmodern.org.
The story you are about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Oh my God, like Zoe, like KABU.
Like for sure, like Kiki. Like radio theater.
Like news.
Like bluegrass.
Like reggae.
Like rock.
Like Grateful Dead.
Like that weird stuff. Like, you know, like...
Like those guys that were like screaming.
Totally. Like, and all those like reporters.
Ladies, please. You only have to like KABU once. On Facebook, go to facebook.com/KABU radio and click on like. Just the facts, ma'am.
Good morning. It's 9:02. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And what's coming up this morning on KABU is first economic update with host economist Richard Wolff. He discusses Ben Bernanke's speech on the Fed's bailout of the biggest financial corporations and new IMF research showing that redistribution to reduce inequality does not hurt growth. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a report from Fukushima 3 years after the meltdown and tsunami. We hear about a new report suggesting that people living around a nuclear reactor in California are suffering negative health impacts. And journalist Robert Perry talks about the real politics driving the Ukraine and the U.S.'s involvement in what may have been a soft coup. And at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen speaks with gardening book author Maggie Stuckey about growing vegetables in containers. Thanks to all you KABU members for your generous support. If you'd like to become a member, please do that by going to kabu.fm on the web and click up where it says Donate Today. We're going to go first this morning to Economic Update with Richard Wolff.
Mm-hmm. day.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, and I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life. I currently teach in the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, a courageous and independent source of news and analysis daily that I urge you to check out. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis and this kind of programming, please know that we also maintain and regularly update two websites that contain lots more of this kind of work. The first one is called rdwolf.com, and the second one, democracyatwork.info. Not only do both of those websites contain information and links and contacts for you that are available without charge 24/7, but also both websites allow you to do two other things. First, communicate with us. Tell us what you want, what you like, questions you'd like us to answer, things like that. We are open. We check every single email that comes in. We do get a great many of them, so we ask you to understand why we can't respond to all of them. But they are a way for us to learn how to better perform for you. And the second thing you can do is follow us on the social media. That is, through both websites, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and so on. Let me turn to the updates for today. I begin with two really short ones, but I think they're important. We are now at the annual celebration of International Women's Day. And since this is a program about economics, I thought I'd say a couple of words on that subject. Whatever advances women have made in the economic sphere of life, and there have been some advances in recent decades, nonetheless, the reality is that women still get less money for the exact same work that men are doing, for which there is no economic justification, let alone the moral and ethical dimensions. But even more important than that, I think, is the failure of our society and many, but particularly here in the United States, the failure to give women the kinds of support they need in our culture to pursue a career, to have a meaningful job outside the home. And the way to do that, of course, would be to provide high-quality, highly secure childcare. Since we leave, as we still do as a society, the overwhelming bulk of the responsibility for childcare, and a good bit of that for elder care as well, on the backs of women, more than men, it behooves us as a society, if we're going to live that way, to at least give women